Radio.
Arguments are not going to attract people. Winning is going to attract people.
Radio.
The Poor People's Riot, as they call it, was necessary, it was reasonable, and it was just.
Radio.
And if you get in my way to make sure that that man gets housing, or that he gets enough to eat, I will move you.
Radio.
Okay.
This is OCAP Radio. We are streaming live online from CKLN on Ryerson Campus in Toronto. Today on the show, we have an interview with Joan Ruzza from Rittenhouse about the Conservative government's so-called law and order agenda. We will also be getting an update about the current situation in Egypt from Mustafa Hanawe. And later in the show, we will chat with Dennis Raphael about the connections between poverty and health. Now for your headlines.
Thank you. So tonight, controversy in Saudi Arabia continues as Manal al-Sharif, the woman jailed for driving and posting videos of herself behind the wheel on YouTube, draws media attention. Al-Sharif posted the videos in question in the hopes that she could inspire other Saudi women to join her in protesting Saudi laws, which prohibit women from driving. Reports have indicated that al-Sharif has received harsher treatment than most women who have been caught driving because of the government's fear of youth-led movements in other Middle Eastern countries. In Saudi Arabia, for example, a significant police presence was put in place to safeguard against potential protests on the international call for a day of rage this past March 11th.
Al-Sharif began a Facebook campaign to encourage women to drive in Saudi Arabia on June 17th. This campaign drew over 13,000 followers before the Saudi government shut it down following Al-Sharif's arrest. Islamic experts have argued that there is nothing in Islam which explicitly prohibits women from driving, and that in Saudi Arabia there has been a conflation of culture and religion, which is not a true representation of Islam. Those in opposition to Al-Sharif have begun alternative Facebook campaigns asking for men to flog women who drive. These threats of violence have had two effects. First is that some women are afraid of the outcomes if they join al-Sharif's campaign. And second, there have been counter pages set up by men who vow to protect women who are interested in driving. There is currently a petition on Facebook asking the Saudi king to release al-Sharif from jail, along with a large Twitter following which is gaining international attention.
And just in case you thought that the G20 was too small a number of government officials making unilateral decisions for the rest of the world, the G8 have convened in France to discuss the Middle East. Leaders of the G8 have met for 2 days this week behind closed doors to discuss the assignment of financial assistance to the Middle East, where dictatorships have recently been overthrown in favor of democracies. Experts estimate that Egypt and Tunisia face a debt of roughly $160 billion over the next 3 years. Here is how the G8 countries have anteed up. The U.S. has forgiven Egypt its $1 billion debt. Britain has pledged $175 million in aid to Egypt and Tunisia over the next 2 years. Don't forget that Britain is nearly bankrupt. Canada has claimed that it has spent $4.6 billion over and above its regular payments since the Pittsburgh G20 summit in 2009. The Harper government claims that $295 million of that $4.6 billion is direct funding. But what about funding now when countries need it most? Harper has issued this statement, quote, "I think that most of the aid that will be delivered will be done through multilateral channels. That's where Canada's focus is likely to be," end quote. Russia has been asked to act as a mediator to resolve the Libyan standoff, but has not yet accepted. The only unanimity among G8 members came with respect to Yemen, where leaders agreed that the current president of Yemen, Ali Abdullah Saleh, must leave.
Organizers of this year's G8 summit have indicated that France has not created a lockdown or fortress situation with steel fences and fake lakes, and that costs have been kept modest in comparison to the amount spent last June in Canada by Stephen Harper and its conservative administration. However, observers have noted that this town, which is bordered by the sea, river, and two horse racetracks, did indeed become an impregnable fortress, allowing government leaders and their associates the luxury of strolling about and mingling with locals for occasional photo ops. Moreover, the French government hired 12,000 police officers, gendarmes, and troops to help secure the seaside resort town of Deauville. All sorts of surveillance and air defenses were activated, a temporary no-fly zone and a maritime exclusion zone were established. There was also two security zones that were devised, which have virtually covered the whole town. Access has only been given to participants, journalists, inhabitants, and workers. Deauville Saint-Gatien Airport and the ports of Deauville and Trouville-sur-Mer were closed throughout the two-day event. News reports also indicate that the French police detained more than 100 protesters yesterday, some of whom occupied a branch of the Banque Nationale de Paris, BNP, to protest the G8 and BNP's support of the nuclear industry. In Paris, Doctors Without Borders hung a giant banner advocating free medical care outside the Stock Exchange building. Another group of activists managed to get inside the offices of credit ratings agency Standards & Poor's. Anti-globalization protesters' only forum in Deauville was the enormous press center, where activists tried to inject an alternative view into the reams of copy put out by around 3,500 accredited journalists.
In some inspiring news, in Wisconsin, a judge has struck down Governor Scott Walker's anti-union law because Republican legislators have failed to provide sufficient public notice before passing measures in March, despite massive protests. The anti-union law seeks to limit all collective bargaining rights of state employees and reduces pensions and benefits to all state employees. Judge Marianne Soumy determined that the law was not passed legally, with the legislator violating the state's open meeting laws and acting in a manner that was not transparent. John Nichols of The Nation magazine argues that while this is a significant victory, the battle will continue in Wisconsin with Republicans attempting to pass the law again. However, he also argues that Judge Sumi's ruling has restored much of the public faith in the court and public system.
And troubling reports continue to surface about conditions in Toronto community housing buildings. The Star reported today that seniors in particular are facing neglect, focusing on one building at 1080 Eastern Avenue, where an elevator has been broken for 8 days. The apartment building, which houses a high proportion of seniors, many of whom are physically impaired and have mobility issues, has effectively trapped its tenants who cannot go outside and perform basic life functions, such as getting groceries and daily exercise. Some lucky residents have friends and family who are helping with food delivery and transportation. One resident injured in a car accident who uses a walking assistance device has not been able to leave the building since last Saturday, nor has she been able to take her dog for a walk, relying instead on her balcony for her dog to perform his necessary functions.
Toronto is in a buzz over the new Bombardier subway cars set to take the tracks on the Yonge University line, the busiest line, in June. Unlike the old trains, these ones will have cars that join as one continuous space to encourage mobility and the spreading of passengers throughout the train. These trains also have a 10% increase in capacity thanks to the reduction of center poles and closed cars. Trains will also feature electronic route maps indicating direction of travel and the next station of destination. Interior surfaces of the train have been coated with Bombardier's antimicrobial surface treatment program, which will purportedly reduce the spread of flu and other viruses. There will also be 3 video screens per car, which will provide safety information. In addition, each car features 2 areas with fold-down seats to accommodate wheelchairs, scooters, mobility devices, bicycles, and strollers. Doors are wider, and the exteriors of the train will be marked with a blue light so that people can enter and exit efficiently.
And now on to some community announcements. The SWAP swap team is getting ready for its largest clothes recycling event in Toronto called Take Off Your Clothes. In 2009, the event saw more than 4,000 garments find new homes, and this year they want to beat the record. The event will be at Trinity Bellwoods Community Center, located at 155 Crawford Street, from 5 to 8 p.m. Tickets are $10 in advance and $15 at the door. Prepare by dropping off bags of clothes in advance or bringing a bag with you. People should bring only 20 items per person.
And the phenomenal food tour from Kitchener-Waterloo to Ottawa continues until Wednesday, June the 22nd, 10:30 a.m., touring from Kitchener-Waterloo to Ottawa. Learn about where Ontario's food comes from, where it goes, and what is being done to make it just, sustainable, and healthy. Cycle from Kitchener-Waterloo to the nation's capital, and along the way, trade your cycling shoes for rubber boots and learn from volunteering on farms across Ontario. Fill your brain with knowledge, hands with soil, and face with food as you collaborate with innovative food activists and pass the learning on to schools across the region.
And there's the City Service Review, which continues. If you're interested in voicing your opinions about arts, culture, and social services, attend one of these public forums, which are open to all and will continue until Tuesday, June the 7th, 11 a.m. Toronto City Council is looking for ways to address the city's $774 million budget shortfall for 2012. Every city service is being assessed for its importance and relevance to residents, which I think in my book they're all relevant and important. Budget decisions will be based on the results of the review. Register now to attend the session, so go to www.toronto.ca/Toronto Service Review/. For questions or more information, don't hesitate to contact Susan at torontoartscouncil.org if you're interested in the arts, if that's your focus. If not, remember, register for a session and attend and let council and the mayor know that social services, the culture and arts are important to you.
And we now take you to a musical break. You'll be listening to Borstal Breakout by Sham 69.
This is Phoenix here with the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty Community Radio, and I'm here with Joan Ruza from Rittenhouse. Rittenhouse is an organization that promotes alternatives to prison, penal abolition, and transformative justice. Thank you, Joan, for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
No worries. So we're here to talk a little bit about the Conservative government's law and order agenda that they brought forth in 2008 in an attempt to increase prison expansion in Canada. So, Joan, what is the law and order? What is Stephen Harper's law and order agenda?
So what they're saying, what the Harper government is saying, is that in order to promote community safety and to protect people from what they call dangerous criminals, that they need to enact harsher laws and build more prisons, so expand the prison industrial complex. The Harper government is a really ideological government, so despite the fact that all the measures they're trying to put in place, like mandatory minimums or harsher sentencing, even though we know from every study that's ever been done that harsher sentencing doesn't actually deter people from committing crimes, they're continuing to push this agenda with no evidence to support what they're doing.
And what has the Harper government done since 2008, since bringing forth this agenda? Like, what has happened? What sort of legislation has passed?
Yeah, so they've had a really strong agenda, and unfortunately, some of what they've done has been supported by other parties, which is obviously quite disappointing. But they've gotten rid of two-for-one. So it used to be that because the conditions in detention centers were so horrific, sometimes people are triple, quadruple bunked while they're in detention centers. These are people that have been charged but not convicted of a crime. That judges used to give people two-for-one. So every day they spent in pretrial detention, they would get 2 days off their sentence. So the Harper government got rid of that. They've imposed mandatory minimum jail sentences for gun offenses, anything related to gun crimes. They raised the age of sexual consent from 14 to 16. They ended early parole for white-collar crime. And, yeah, they've made it more difficult for certain types of people who've committed certain types of crimes to get a pardon.
Wow. Wow. So what can we expect now that the Harper government's been reelected and we now have a majority? Like, what can we expect from moving, like, from the days to come?
Right. So they're continuing to try to promote this culture of fear by saying, you know, we have to be fearful of organized crime. We need to be fearful of dangerous criminals. And now that they're a majority, of course, it's going to be much easier for them to push stuff through Parliament. So what they've done is they've taken like 11 bills that were sort of moving through Parliament before the election was called. And they've now put them all together in something that's called an omnibus bill. So what will happen is Parliament will have to pass all of these bills together as one bill, which means there's a lot less opportunity for debate. And because they have a majority, the opposition won't be in a position to stop those bills from passing. So it's obviously quite concerning for anyone who cares about prisoners' rights or human rights in general, because, yeah, it just becomes much more complex in terms of how do we move forward with trying to fight these things.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What sort of bills are being lumped into this omnibus bill?
So among the bills, some of which have been talked about in the media quite a bit, is mandatory minimum sentencing for drug crimes. And what this means, I think people are sort of under a false impression that the government's been trying to say that leaders of organized crime are going to be the people that are targeted by this bill. But it includes things like you could get 6 months in jail for having 5 marijuana plants. Mm-hmm. And that if you're caught trafficking a larger amount, you could get a minimum of 2 years for marijuana. Mm-hmm. It's completely mm-hmm. ridiculous. So what this really means is that low-level dealers and people with drug use issues, and probably in a lot of cases a lot of youth, are the ones who are going to be targeted by this bill, are going to spend a lot of time behind bars. And again, mandatory minimum sentencing has been used in other countries. It's been a complete abysmal failure. Mm-hmm. It has not stopped that behavior at all. It's just put more people in prison mm-hmm, mm-hmm. for longer periods of time. So there's that one. They want to get rid of house arrest, even for things like property crime. So someone who's been convicted of theft would have to go to prison, which is completely ridiculous. Mm-hmm. Why are we putting people who've committed property crimes in jail? They want to make it even more difficult for people to get pardons, particularly people who have committed violent crimes. Mm-hmm. So they're just, and they're also trying to get rid of the word pardon and change it to record suspension. So obviously the idea of pardon is like, almost like the idea of forgiveness. Mm-hmm. Like you've served your time and now it's done, and they're trying to take that away. Mm-hmm. And, you know, not having a pardon makes things very difficult for people in terms of access, in terms of getting employment. So it's just going to make it more and more difficult for people to sort of move forward with their lives. Mm-hmm. They want to make harsher laws for youth. So they want to have more pretrial custody for youth rather than youth being able to serve their wow. pretrial time in the community. And they also want to get rid of a publication ban. So right now, the names of youth can't be published in the paper, but they want to get rid of that by mm-hmm. suggesting that somehow it promotes community safety, when in fact all it does is stigmatize youth who, yep. Again, have not been convicted, have only mm-hmm. been charged mm-hmm. of a crime. So it's quite problematic. And there's this really disturbing thing they're trying to push through that allows surveillance of our internet communication. So they would be able to, without a warrant, like it used to be that you would have to have what's called reasonable cause yeah. to look at someone's computer or to what they're looking at, but now they wouldn't need that. And one of the things they want to do is that if you are seen, if you're linked to a site that's seen as having hate material on it, and like we don't know what that means, who's deciding what that means and mm-hmm. what mm-hmm. websites would be covered under that you could actually be charged as a result of that and get quite a serious mm-hmm. crime. And again, because it's an omnibus bill, it's going to mean that there's been very little debate about this issue and what it means for people's privacy and invasion of privacy. Yeah. So people are quite worried about it. And then there's other issues around transferring people from one country to another. And there's also stuff around terrorism, which means that people could be detained without charge if they're seen as somehow being involved in what's considered terrorist activities.
Wow. So, I mean, it's clear that we can see that these bills are pushing to further criminalize youth, further criminalize communities, poor communities, racialized communities, and further push the criminalization of dissent. And it's clear for us to see this. And with what's going on in the states right now with the mandatory minimums, and a lot of states are pushing away from the tougher on crime. So why is the government doing this? Like, why is Harper doing this? Like, what is his intent when, you know, studies show that this is an unsuccessful route to take? And we can clearly see what his intentions are. But could you speak a little bit to those intentions?
Well, I think it's a number of things. One of them is that law and order agendas win elections, because if you create a culture of fear, like, people are sort of willing to give up a lot of their liberties. And if you create an us and them mentality, that it's like there's this certain segment of the population that's dangerous and threatening, and tell them that the only way you can be protected is to remove those people from society, people really buy into that. And the media is completely complicit, because the media sort of only tells the most sensationalistic stories about crime. They tell it in a really one-sided way, so that, you know, a person who's accused of something is only known as the thing that they've done. So we call people murderers, we call people rapists. Like, they are completely defined and distilled down to that one act.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, they've created a culture of fear. And there's also a huge monetary component to it. I mean, there's a lot of companies that are going to make a lot of money from prison expansion. The government wants to spend $9 billion spending new prisons, despite the fact that our crime rate in Canada has been dropping since 1994, and the crime severity index has also been dropping. But yeah, it's a huge moneymaker. Like, if you look on the CSC website, you can actually see what different corporations have contracts with CSC and how much money they're making. So part of it's profit, and, you know, human beings are going to have their lives destroyed because of profit and fear-mongering.
Mm-hmm. So further marginalizing segments of the population to profit is basically what the intent we're looking
absolutely.
At.
And I think it's totally about social control, and that anyone who falls outside of a very narrow, dominant culture is seen as being threatening, and we want to remove those people. And as you were saying about the criminalization of dissent, we saw particularly in the G20 how far the police and the government are willing to go to stop people from any kind of dissent against the government.
So can you speak a little bit to what communities will be directly affected by things like mandatory minimum for drug offenses, and specifically the youth bills? What communities will be targeted?
Sure. So I can talk about that generally, and then how that will apply specifically to these bills. So if we look at who's in prison, we're sort of given the impression, again, that, you know, we need to build prisons to protect people from dangerous people. But if we look at who's actually in prison, 81% of people are in for nonviolent crimes. 40% of people in Ontario prisons are in on remand, which means they've been charged but not convicted of a crime. And we have a real overrepresentation of Indigenous people in particular. Indigenous people make up 3% of the Canadian population, but 23% of the prison population. Sun Prairie Province is 77%.
Yeah.
There's an overrepresentation of racialized communities, people with psychiatric disabilities, people who are drug users, because drug use is criminalized. We're now seeing the criminalization of queer people, trans people, and people with HIV, which is another huge concern of what's happening right now. So these are the communities that are generally targeted, and these are also the communities that will be specifically affected by these bills, especially things around mandatory minimums, and people living in poverty will also be specifically targeted and impacted by these bills.
Wow, this is really intense to think that now, you know, Harper has a majority government and is going to be able to push forward with all these bills really quickly. So what can we do? What are the next steps for people doing, you know, this kind of abolition work, or just for people that want to ally and support?
So I think in the days after the election, I actually was feeling quite despairing, because I thought, yeah, how do we move forward now that we have a majority government? But I think the way I've been trying to look at it is just that we still need to be focusing on raising public awareness, because there are still a lot of people, because we're fed so much misinformation by the media, that people just don't understand what's going on, which I think is part of the reason that the Conservatives got a majority, although let's be clear that 40% is not a majority, but the way our electoral system works, it's seen as a majority. So yeah, we need to keep raising public awareness. If your MP is someone who you think is sympathetic to these issues, like, in this riding where my workplace is, it's Bob Rae. So Bob Rae is it's quite possible that Bob Rae would be sympathetic. Or in where I live, it's Olivia Chow, who I know would be sympathetic. So trying to, you know, meet with people, find out who the new justice critic is going to be, and just continue to try to yeah, just to raise awareness and let people know that the direction we're moving is absolutely the wrong direction to be going.
Awesome. Great. Well, thank you. Thank you for the interview, and it was really informative, and thank you.
Thanks.
That was King Sunny Ade with Yoruba.
I had the opportunity to interview Dennis Raphael last week. He is a professor of health policy and management at York University. He is also co-author of the report Social Determinants of Health, The Canadian Facts, which is available at thecanadianfacts.org, and several books including Social Determinants of Health, Canadian Perspectives, and Poverty and Policy in Canada, Implications for Health and Quality of Life. He is an expert about the relationship between poverty and health, and we are very pleased to have him on our show.
There's lots of research that you and other people have been doing about the connections between poor health and poverty. Can you just give us a bit of an overview about what those connections are?
Generally, it's been known since the 1850s that people living under conditions of material and social deprivation show a variety of health, adverse health outcomes. And it's pretty well any known affliction, any known disease, any known behavioral, social problem is closely related to living in poverty and living under conditions of material and social deprivation. Now, while this has been known for such a long period of time, for whatever reason, the connection has not made it onto the health agenda. Certainly health and health care and promoting health and reducing and preventing illness is a high priority for Canadians, but the obvious connection between poverty or material and social deprivation has not made it onto any kind of level of consciousness. And to make it even worse, the primary determinants of the extent of poverty within a country is public policy. And most Canadians are not well-versed in various aspects of public policy. So if you think that the way to prevent poverty and to improve health is to enact public policy that supports the quality of living conditions, it outlines a whole variety of barriers to having this addressed. I think the most disturbing aspect for someone like me is that considering the concern that exists about preventing illness, promoting health, and the known fact that people in the healthcare community, in the public health community, in a variety of health settings actually knows it, the connection between poverty and health, the failure to raise this issue and to have the Canadian public become aware of it is especially disturbing.
Can you give us a couple specific examples of areas where poor people have very dramatic increases in
I'll give you some areas where not only is the evidence really strong, but that the contrast between what's known and what's communicated to the public is really is disturbing. Cardiovascular disease, heart attack, stroke, and type 2 diabetes, which is the inability of the body to use the insulin that's available to process sugar. And when the body's unable to do that, you end up with what's called adult onset diabetes, and it leads to very bad outcomes. People know what the outcomes of heart disease are, but in the case of type 2 diabetes, you have amputations, you have blindness, you have kidney failure, you also have heart disease. Well, an extensive amount of evidence has arisen that indicates that children who live under conditions of deprivation, in other words, children who live in poverty, are especially prone to develop this, both these diseases, cardiovascular disease and type 2 diabetes, during adulthood. And these effects seem to be embedded, meaning that by the time you've been a child living in poverty, you carry this risk with you into adulthood, regardless of what happens to you in later life. So what it basically means is the worst situation to be in is living in poverty as a child, as an adolescent, as a young adult, and as an older adult. But even if as a child you live in poverty, where 15% of our children in Canada do, even if you were to transcend this and become not living in poverty, you still carry a significant degree of risk. Now, knowing this and knowing the concern there is about cardiovascular disease and type 2 diabetes and the human and economic cost to it, we would think that the people charged with preventing these diseases, whether they're ministries of health, whether they're the disease associations, whether they're the healthcare and public health communities, would highlight this and would make some attempt to communicate to the public that a really good way of preventing cardiovascular disease and type 2 diabetes is to reduce child poverty. But they won't do it. They don't do it. So when I give my presentations and talks, or when I teach this poverty and health course that has 200 students in it, students hear this for the first time. But also healthcare providers seem to hear it for the first time. So you have to wonder how seriously do these agencies and do governments take the prevention of disease and illness if they're unwilling to raise what the primary determinants of these diseases are and advocate or enact public policy that would serve to reduce it.
Do you have a hypothesis as to why that's the case?
Well, there's a variety of reasons that come together in the case of the North American situation. And these are not necessarily in order of importance. The first thing is that generally the United States and Canada are what are called liberal political economies. And that is they give primary influence and dominance to the marketplace. So generally, everything is concerned with growing the economy, with rather less emphasis given to providing citizens with security. Now, luckily, we have some contrast to this, and it's not only the social democratic countries of Norway, Sweden, Denmark, and Finland that intervene in the operation of the economy in order to provide citizens with basic security, as well as a whole range of benefits that prevent poverty. But we also have the example of what are called the conservative welfare states in continental Europe of France, Germany, Belgium, and Holland, that while they're certainly not socialists, do have the sense that we have to support our citizens. In North America, and it's not only, it's the UK as well and Ireland, in addition to Canada and the United States, there's less concern with that because the business sector tends to dominate public policy making. And when the business sector dominates, they tend to de-emphasize issues of fair taxation, social safety net, citizen security. The second component, which is tightly related to the dominance of the business community, is the emphasis on individualism. And that is, we're taught that everybody's responsible for their own behavior and their own future. So if you're poor, you brought it on yourself through poor lifestyle choices or a lack of motivation to succeed in school. So individualism is a powerful philosophy that attempts to explain both good outcomes and bad outcomes. So if everybody's responsible for their bad health outcomes, it diverts attention away from the important role that society and its public policies play. The third aspect of this is that in a very conservative political environment, and especially where these agencies, be they ministries, the hospitals, health units, diabetes associations, heart and stroke associations, they're either funded by governments that are implementing what we would call adverse public policy, but they're also dependent for fundraising on people who may not subscribe to the view that people that are poor and that are getting sick have not brought it on themselves, but are actually victims of the way the economic system is being operated. So when you combine conservative political environments, liberal political economies that generally tend not to support citizens, you combine that with the ideology of individualism that promulgated through the media and through schools and through ideology of newspapers, the media, and then you combine that with the reticence of the agencies charged with preventing illness and promoting health to raise these issues for a variety of reasons, you kind of have a perfect storm by which not only are the objective situation of people getting worse, but the explanation for all of this gets hyped up and ends up being emphasized, the so-called healthy lifestyle choices. So the people that are victims are not only suffering material deprivation, but then they're being told that you brought this on yourself, and that's an explanation that the society promulgates to explain all these adverse health outcomes. So people that get heart attacks smoke, they're overweight, they don't exercise, when all of the objective research evidence indicates that these factors play a marginal role in these adverse health outcomes. And it's not only the big ones I've mentioned of cardiovascular disease and type 2 diabetes. Poor children are twice as likely to have asthma, they're more likely to be injured, they're more likely to be in emergency rooms. Working class adults are twice as likely to get diabetes. I mentioned diabetes, but they're also twice as likely to get arthritis. They're twice as likely to have dementia, Alzheimer's, just about every disease. And then you include the mental health afflictions. Lower income, poor people are more likely to commit suicide. They're more likely to be depressed. Just about everything. But despite what we know about poverty and the material and social deprivation that causes all of these illnesses, the links between these is not being raised and not being communicated to the public in any systematic manner.
And obviously there are certain things that we would think would lead to poor health for poor people, like inadequate nutrition, poor housing. Are there other things that systemically mean that poor people have poorer health?
Well, they all cluster together. There's income, there's housing, there's early childhood development. The schools tend to be more problematic in low-income areas. Communities are unsafe. People have perceive they have lack of control. People who are poor are less likely to be able to make sense out of what's happening. So it's actual material deprivation. And related to that is this lack of psychosocial control. But there's some other things that we just didn't mention that are related to being poor. In addition to income and food insecurity and bad housing, the jobs that low-income people take are more precarious, more insecure, have lack of control. So there's this whole clustering of disadvantage that's associated with being poor. The really distressing part of this is that the countries that do well on this not only do well in preventing poverty in the first place through wages and stronger unions, they also are the ones that provide supports to people in general. So what it means is that generally wage poverty is lower in the continental and Scandinavian countries. And these countries are more likely to provide child care, job training, housing. In countries such as Canada, not only is there a tremendous amount of wage-related poverty, But in addition to being poor, we don't go out of our way to provide you with child care. We don't go out of the way to make sure you have a place to live. We don't go out of the way to make sure that you're getting job training. So it leads to this spiral of adverse health outcomes that, again, not only are focused on health, but are focused to a whole range of educational social outcomes, such as crime, such as lack of school achievement. So it's really not good, and the objective evidence coming from the United Ways, coming from the Health Council of Canada, coming from even the Conference Board of Canada, is that we're heading in the wrong direction, and it can't be good for any of us.
And what if we had a dramatic shift and all of a sudden the provincial government put in a minimum wage that was tied to a living wage and raised social assistance rates by 55%, which would put people back at real wages to pre-1995 cuts?
Things would be better.
What kind of impact would that have on people's health?
Well, it might have an immediate impact. Sometimes in my class I show the incomes of the top 20% of the population. And, oh, let's say it's around the average family in the top 20% has income of about $170,000. And the average income of the bottom 20% of families is about $15,000. If you transfer through tax policy and progressive taxation $10,000 from the people at the top, such that their average family income went from $170,000 to $160,000, there would be no health effects, but the health effects of the people getting $15,000 that would now be raised to $25,000 would be profound. There would be no need to go to food banks, there would be no need to get used clothing, and probably you begin to see an immediate turnaround in terms of mental health, sense of control, and probably within a relatively short period of time we'd start to see improvements in health.
Great. Is there anything else you want to tell us today?
Ultimately, the solution is in the political realm, that ultimately parties that are receptive of these concepts have to be put into power. The other thing I would mention is we did produce a public primer on these broader issues, and it's called Social Determinants of Health, the Canadian Facts, and it's available for free on the internet. And if you simply type into Google Social Determinants of Health, the Canadian Facts, and it's been downloaded about 35,000 times so far. So it's a good introduction to all of these issues.
Great. Thank you very much.
That was Nasrallah with Salam. This is Lindsay, co-hosting OCAP Radio. On the line with us is Mustafa Hanawi. Mustafa is an activist, journalist, and former host of OCAP Radio based in Montreal. Hi, Mustafa.
Hello.
Thanks for joining us.
No, thank you for having me on OCAP Radio.
So we talked to you a few months ago near the beginning of the uprisings in Egypt. Obviously, a lot has happened since then. Can you give us an update about what has occurred since we last talked to you and what is currently happening there?
What's been happening in Egypt over the past, since February 11th, has been a process in which the country's been ruled by the Supreme Military Council in Egypt since February 11th until this date, until elections are set, until September. And what's been happening during this period in terms of the government or the Egyptian state has been a course of sort of trying to create a sense of stability within Egypt for its own interests, and both not trying to allow sort of a larger unrest to happen in Egypt. So you've been seeing two things happen. On one hand, you have an army that's giving in to the demands of the Egyptian revolution, so putting Mubarak on trial, putting many members of the NDP or the National Democratic Party on trial from charges from brutality and murder of protesters during the revolution to corruption charges. The opening of the Rafah border has been another example. Yet at the same time, what the Egyptian army has been doing has been arresting hundreds and thousands of activists in this period since February 11th. So, and putting them through military trials. So really sort of rolling back even the justice system that existed in Egypt prior to the revolution, that most of the activists being detained or arrested are being put through sort of a military justice system or by military trial. So these are the things that are happening in Egypt since February 11th. And what you have on the ground as a response is you sort of have the continuation of the revolution. The space opened up since February 11th to really begin to organize, to build different movements. So you had in Egypt, you had the formation of sort of two progressive larger parties, one of them being the Popular Socialist Alliance, which is a grouping of social democrats, anti-capitalist members of the Socialist Renewal, Egyptian Communist Party, the Revolutionary Socialist Group, sort of form a broader progressive anti-capitalist revolutionary party within Egypt. At the same time, you have independent trade unions forming practically every week. You have a national network called the Progressive Youth in Defense of the Revolution that have been organizing nationally in Egypt to sort of begin to formulate long-term campaigns and a sense of popular mobilization. You know, since then, you've had several large demonstrations or mobilizations in Egypt. You've had in February and March, practically every Friday, massive demonstrations in Tahrir demanding a push forward with the demands of the revolution. During May 15th, on the anniversary, 63rd anniversary of the Nakba or the catastrophe, you had massive demonstrations in Tahrir in solidarity with Palestine, an attempt by Egyptian activists to actually storm the Israeli embassy, and hundreds were actually injured in those demonstrations. So the revolution has really sort of continued on the ground to push for the demands and to build sort of a new kind of Egypt. Student unions have been forming. So really Egypt has become such a vibrant place politically and on the ground, but yet the Supreme Military Council is still controlling the Egyptian state and is still the caretaker of the Egyptian state. So what's been happening, or today, maybe people have seen, is that tens of thousands of people actually marched to Tahrir Square and are taking Tahrir Square permanently until two demands are met. One, the demand to the revolution, sort of the democratization of Egyptian society, and a move forward, quicker move forward towards democracy in Egypt, but also at the same time, a release of all the activists arrested by the military in Egypt. So those are the two main demands, and that was called for by the Popular Committees in Defense of the Revolution, that are these neighborhood-based committees that came out of the January 25th revolution. Another thing that happened in Egypt since then, which is important, is you've actually had, for the first time, an International Women's Day march take place in Egypt. It was attacked, but it by unknown thugs, but it still happened. So Egypt's become very vibrant, but at the same time, people are calling for this takeover at Tahrir to serve to confront a counter-revolution. And that counter-revolution in Egypt is the main threat, is the Egyptian military at this point.
Okay, thanks. So something that we've seen through the mainstream media is they've been portraying this as something that happened sort of spontaneously. Can you talk about some of the organizing, the long-term organizing that went into the revolution?
On January 25th, there's sort of what you would say a pre-revolution history that sort of takes place in Egypt that begins in 2000 during the Second Intifada. And what happens during the Second Intifada is sort of you have a mass outrage of Egyptians and sort of the largest demonstrations since the bread riots in 1977. So you have student occupations, demonstrations in Tahrir, and that takes place until 2001, 2002. And then during the occupation and invasion of Iraq, you have a million-person demonstration in Tahrir Square. Because of Egypt's support for the U.S. occupation of Iraq. And because of that, what happens in 2003 and 2004, Egypt is actually rewarded by the U.S. with a massive structural adjustment program package brokered by the IMF and the World Bank. And at the same time in 2004, you have this concept of succession. So Gamal Mubarak, Hosni Mubarak's son, and sort of a newer business class, begin to take the portfolios within the cabinet and the policy committee of the National Democratic Party. And as a result, in 2004, you actually have several movements actually spur out of the organizing in Iraq, of solidarity with Iraq and Palestine. So the first of those groupings was Kefaya, which means enough, Yabasta, and then it was a coalition to sort of to put forward real democratic reforms, oppose the security measures in Egypt that have lasted until this very moment, and to have free and fair elections and an open press. And that lasted until 2005, until the parliamentary elections. And then in 2006, what happens in economically is in Mahalla, a textile town in the Nile Delta, you have over 27,000 workers go on an undeclared, sort of an untimed strike, so an ongoing strike for demands of a minimum wage, for demands of subsidized food prices, for demands of public ownership to remain of the textile mill in Mahalla, the largest textile mill in the Middle East, and over those 27,000 workers had went on strike for months. After that, in 2008, in support of that strike and in support of sort of a workers' movement that grows out of 2006, Mahalla really opened the can of worms in terms of organizing, worker organizing in Egypt. And you have independent unions being formed. You have strikes in the tax collectors. You have strikes in various public sectors. And then in 2008, a general strike is called for by a group of youth called the April 6th Youth Movement. And this April 6th Youth Movement, the idea was to support worker organizing amongst broader Egyptian society. So on April 6th, it didn't carry anywhere, but in Mahalla, what you had was over 100,000 people take to the streets in 2 days. Three people were killed, and it was labeled the Mahalla Intifada. And out of that comes the April 6th youth movement. And then that worker organizing continued. And what you have in 2010 is you have another movement that sort of comes out of the brutality of the police, Egyptian police state. And just to put figures out there, Egypt spends four times more on internal security than it does on its health care. And in 2010, a blogger named Khaled Said is brutally murdered by Egyptian police in Alexandria for putting up a video of police officers beating up another Egyptian youth. And he's killed by state security service forces. And what comes out of that is We Are All Khaled Said, sort of a large movement of Egyptian middle-class youth to protest around Egyptian police brutality. So that anger was always fomented by an Egyptian state that became sort of a neoliberal dictatorship that was waging a war on its own population over the course of the past 10 years. And that's the anger and that's the organizing that sort of contributes to January 25th. So it wasn't that it was spontaneous by any means. And the people that organized January 25th were We Were All Khaled Said, the Muslim Brotherhood Youth, the April 6th Youth Movement, Al Barada Youth Campaign, Youth Committee. So really, the movements in Egypt had called for January 25th, but had no direction in terms of, had no sense of how large it was going to be. And then when Tunis had actually happened, it sort of became the spark that sort of made this demonstration larger than any one single protest, and with the hopes and the aims to actually put down Mubarak's regime, which did happen.
Thank you so much for joining us, Mustafa, and thanks for that update.
No, thank you. And for people to stay in tune in terms of what's happening in Egypt, sort of a minute-by-minute sort of basis in terms of the occupation of Tahrir, they can go to arabay.org, arabawi.org, and it's a blog put up by Hossam al-Hamalawi, an Egyptian blogger, journalist, who's been an activist in Egypt for quite some time. Also, there's El Masr El Youm, which is the Egyptian oppositional daily.
Okay, thank you.
No, thank you.
So tonight, OCAP is celebrating 20 years of organizing by John Clark, one of the organizers with OCAP, at the Blue Moon Pub. It's just east of Broadview on the south side on Queen. Thanks for listening to this edition of OCAP Radio. Don't touch that mouse. Thanks for Mark for teching, Chital and Susie for the headlines, Kelly White for co-hosting. Up next is Vantana Alberio with Maria Elena Escobar. Keep streaming on CKLN FM.
Saturday's boys live life with themselves. Dream lots of beer and wait for half-time results. Afternoon tea in the lighter by chat the girls. They dig it. Saturday's girls work in Tesco's and Woolworths. Wear cheap perfume cause it's all they can afford. Go to discos, they do baby sham. Talk to Jane with bingo accents. La 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 la. Saturday's kids play one-armed bandits. They never win, but it's not the point, is it? Dipping silver paper when their pints go flat. How about that? Mums and dads smoke caps, do not filters. Wallpaper lives cause they all die of cancer. What goes on, what goes wrong? Save up their money for a holiday to Shelbyville or Brackleton Bay. Think about the future when they're settled down. Met a girl next door, we've won on the way. These are the real creatures that time has forgot, not given a thought. It's the system, hate the system, smash the system. La 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 la
live in council houses, wear V-neck shirts and baggy trousers, drive Cortinas with a fur dashboard, stays on the seat in the back of course. La 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 la